Well, good morning. We're going to be starting in Numbers chapter 34, verse 13 today. Last time how we got here is we started in Numbers chapter 32, verse 28, where Moses communicates the arrangement made with the tribes of Gad and Reuben, and before it's done, the half-tribe of Manasseh as well, about staying east of the Jordan. And Moses communicates those arrangements to Joshua and to Eleazar and also then to the heads of the various tribes. And these two and a half tribes will settle east of Jordan in the Amorite area. But when the conquest begins, all of their armed men are committed to go and join in the conquest of Canaan and to help the other nine and a half tribes possess their inheritance, and they're going to stay and fight and be there to the end, is the promise. And there is also some conquest mentioned at the end of the chapter, because there are two prominent members of the tribe of Manasseh that conquered some additional cities to the north that had not yet been taken, that were part of the Amorites. And then we moved on to chapter 33, and Moses retraces the steps of the Israelites from Egypt through the Exodus, highlighted some sites where significant events happened. For example, he included Mount Hor and Aaron's death, and we find out that Aaron was 123 years old when he passed on. Also, the wilderness of Zin, where Moses did not display the proper reverence for God's holiness, and so when he struck the rock, that was sinful. It was against the way God had given him specific instructions on how to do it. And as a result, God let him know he would not be entering the promised land with the rest of the tribes. And also through that time, God told the people that when they came to the promised land, they were to drive out all the inhabitants. They were to destroy the idols and the high places. And they were to possess the land, and there was going to be owned by families through the casting of lots. And the larger groups, be it at the tribe level or at the individual family level, would get larger allotments. And then in chapter 34, God told them what the borders would be. It's hard for us to read it and be very exact in our understanding of it, because many of the cities that were mentioned to locate those borders, we don't know where they are anymore. But one that was very clear was the western border, being the Mediterranean Sea. And it's very clear that God was not including Gaza in that, which was rather frustrating, trying to understand why some of these conservative Christian groups, when they published their teaching, would carve out Gaza there and show that as part of something that God held back from the Israelites, which he did not do. And that takes us to Numbers chapter 34, verse 13, where we're going to start today. And I'm going to read 13 through 29. 34, 13 to 29. Before I read, though, I got a question for you. How many chapters are in Numbers?
36.
So we are quickly approaching the end, and these next two chapters, I don't want to call them loose ends, but they're tying together the final things that need tied together before we would go on and think about the conquest of Canaan. Of course, the approach that we're taking does leave some other information that could have been pursued out. I don't mean leaves it clear out, but it might have been explained with a different way, with a little bit different kind of detail, when you think about the book of Deuteronomy in particular. And so if you want to go pursue those, I would encourage you to read Deuteronomy at your own time of choosing. I'm not going to take the time in here to do it. We're going to use Numbers as our bridge from the Exodus to the conquest of Canaan, as we see in the book of Joshua. But so you can just kind of mentally start preparing for that, start thinking about, oh, we're going to be crossing the Jordan in our reading with the Israelites very soon. So we'll be wrapping these things up maybe as soon as next week. I'm not quite sure how far I'll get today. We'll just take it as it comes. But beginning in verse 13 of Numbers 34, So Moses commanded the sons of Israel, saying, "This is the land that you are to apportion by lot among you as a possession, which the Lord has commanded to give to the 9.5 tribes. For the tribe of the sons of Reuben have received theirs according to their fathers' households, and the tribe of the sons of Gad according to their fathers' households, and the half tribe of Manasseh have received their possession. The 2.5 tribes have received their possession across the Jordan opposite Jericho, eastward toward the sun rising." Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "These are the names of the men who shall apportion the land to you for inheritance: Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun. You shall take one leader of every tribe to apportion the land for inheritance. These are the names of the men of the tribe of Judah: Caleb the son of Jephunneh, one of the tribe of, let me just start verse 20 again, of the tribe of the sons of Simeon, Samuel the son of Ammihud, of the tribe of Benjamin, Eliadad the son of Chislon, of the tribe of the sons of Dan, a leader, Buki the son of Jogli, of the sons of Joseph, the tribe of Manasseh, the sons of Manasseh, a leader, Haniel the son of Ephod, of the tribe of the sons of Ephraim, a leader, Kemuel, the son of Shipthon, of the tribe of the sons of Zebulun, a leader, Elizaphan, the son of Parnach, of the tribe of the sons of Issachar, a leader, Paltiel, the son of Azin, of the tribe of the sons of Asher, a leader, Ahihud, the son of Shelomai, of the tribe of the sons of Naphtali, a leader, Pedahel, the son of Amminahud. These are those whom the Lord commanded to apportion the inheritance to the sons of Israel in the land of Canaan. Well, isn't that a passage? So we begin in verse 13 a discussion about this is the mechanics of how you're going to go about, maybe I shouldn't say the mechanics, but the people who are going to go about and have responsibility for apportioning or laying out who goes to what land. And it's land given by Yahweh to the 9.5 tribes. The east of the Jordan's already taken care of, and it's not a part of the promised land as defined previously when God talked about them crossing the Jordan, the boundaries that we put up just a week ago or 2 weeks ago, whatever that was. But Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, they've got theirs. They're to the east toward the sunrise. But Yahweh gives these instructions to Moses. And who are the main leaders? Well, it's Eleazar, the new high priest, new in that after Moses' brother has already passed away. And Joshua, they're to oversee it. And then there's going to be one leader from each of the tribes. And God picked them. And I think that was a real kindness on the part of God. Can you imagine? We're going to have one. Which one of you guys wants to go do this? And I bet you there would be lots of people that thought they were the one that should do it. But God, through Moses, picked them. That conflict is just over before it starts. Now, when we read through these men, are they all pretty well known to you? No, save one. Which one is known to you?
Caleb.
Caleb was there from the tribe of Judah, and because of his faithfulness, God said, you're going to be leading not only in the battle to come, but in the apportionment of the land. And so God's laid out how this is going to happen. And that's pretty much what we read here, who would be involved with it. And boy, wasn't that quick on chapter 34, the last part of it. Any questions or comments? Okay, so let's go on with Numbers chapter 35. And I'm going to begin by reading the first 14 verses of Numbers 35. Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho, saying, "Command the sons of Israel that they give to the Levites from the inheritance of their possession cities to live in. And you shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the cities. The cities shall be theirs to live in, and their pasture lands shall be for their cattle and for their herds and for all of their beasts. The pasture lands of the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall extend from the wall of the city outward 1,000 cubits around. You shall also measure out the city on the east 2,000 cubits, and on the south 2,000 cubits, and on the west side 2,000 cubits, and on the north side 2,000 cubits, with the city in the center. This shall become theirs as pasture lands for the cities. The cities which you shall give to the Levites shall be the 6 cities of refuge, which you shall give for the manslayer to flee to. And in addition to them, you shall give 42 cities. All of the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall be 48 cities, together with their pasture lands. As for the cities which you shall give from the possession of the sons of Israel, you shall take more from the larger, and you shall take less from the smaller. Each shall give some of his cities to the Levites in proportion to his possession which he inherits. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall select for yourselves cities to be your cities of refuge, that the manslayer who has killed any person unintentionally may flee there. The cities shall be to you as a refuge from the avenger, so that the manslayer will not die until he stands before the congregation for trial. The cities which you are to give shall be your 6 cities of refuge. You shall give 3 cities across the Jordan and 3 cities in the land of Canaan. They are to be cities of refuge." All right. And it's kind of maybe an awkward spot to stop, but we'll talk about the following verses in a little bit. So God is saying to Moses, tell the Israelites that when they cross the Jordan, they're going to give the Levites, out of their own inheritance, cities to live in and pasture around the cities. So one of the things that is clear is the Levites don't get an apportionment like the other tribes do. But instead, the other tribes are to give up cities that they get within their area to be the cities of the Levites. And the Levites then will have these cities both to live in, and they're going to have pasture around the cities for their livestock to graze on. And so they will be under ownership of the Levites. Now, we talk about the pasture, and this pasturing area around each city that they choose to give will be 1,000 cubits to the south, to the north, to the east, and to the west, outside of the city walls. Well, a cubit's about 18 inches, and I can't help it. I always do this to see if it's interesting. And I looked at this a couple times and said, well, in one sense, I ought to probably not say what I'm going to say because it's a little bit misleading, but I'll say it. But let's start here. If you assume that the city is the size of a dot. Now, it's not, is it? No. It's going to be far bigger than a dot, okay? But then you're going to go 1,000 cubits in each direction. And it's easy enough then to do some math and say, well, if a cubit is about 18 inches, which it varies between 17 and 18, something like that generally. There are some other ones that happen. But when you get all done, if you go 1,500 feet in each direction, you're going to wind up with about 160 acres if you go down through the math and so on. Now, they get more than that, because as you start to stretch out to the city walls from a dot, all the length of the wall goes into that as well. And it's going to be more than that. And that's who gets control of that? Did you pick that out in verse 4? Who controls that central 1,000 cubits in each direction from the wall? Huh? I heard somebody say, yeah, Levites. That's the Levites' pasture. But then it goes on and talks about, well, we're going to go out also 2,000 cubits from each wall in those same directions. That's also pasture. Well, who's that pasture for? The city as a whole. So not, we find out right away the city isn't going to be limited to only Levites living there. It's going to be a mixture of people who are living in the Promised Land as well as the Levites. And by the way, there's a square relationship in the area of a square. Doesn't that sound intelligent? That turns out to be about 640 acres, including the Levites' portion. So that's about what it would be if the city were the size literally of a dot. I don't know if that means much or not. In verse 6, God goes on to say, of these Levitical cities, six of them will be cities of refuge. There's a total of 48, right? 42 plus the 6. A total of 48. And in verse 6, he says, this is going to be a place where the manslayer can flee to, and without a whole lot more comment, we'll talk about that more as we go along, but there's 48 cities. So to visualize what the tribes are being asked to give up, there is a good statement in here that says the more they're going to be given more cities from the people that have more land. Kind of makes sense. You get a big inheritance because you got a big family. Oh, well, then you're going to be asked to give more with regard to the establishment of these cities. But this land of Israelites is about the size of New Jersey. So if you want to start thinking about that, I don't know how many. I could have looked, but I didn't think about it. How many cities are in New Jersey? I don't know. I bet you there's a few more than 48, but I don't know. But that's the size of the space we're talking about. Now, three of the cities, as we keep going, as we read about the cities of refuge, are actually going to be over on the east side. I should do it like this for you, shouldn't I? Over on the east side, the east side of the Jordan. So you're actually going to have 45 cities in the Canaanite area and three cities east of the Jordan over where we see the 2.5 tribes are being settled. And in verses 9 through 14, we get more about these cities. That the six cities are going to be places of refuge, that if you have killed someone, you can flee to. If your killing of that person was unintentional, the manslayer can go there. And it's to be a refuge from the avenger. It's a protection from death by the avenger until he can have a trial before the congregation. God is establishing some justice here. The avenger was selected by the family of the one slain. And what that avenger's role is to assure that Genesis chapter 9, verse 6 is carried out. So go to Genesis 9, 6. With regard to timing, this is given by God to Noah right after he comes off of the ark. See if I can get there myself. And 9 chapter 6 says this, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made the man. And so God establishes a responsibility for mankind after the flood, starting with the family of Noah, if a man sheds someone's blood, talking about then kills them, then that person's life shall be taken by man. And the concept behind it is, the importance behind it is, the man that was killed, he was the image of God. It's a direct affront to God when someone kills a man because, and I mean by mankind, someone in the human race, because we are created in the image of God. And so that was a responsibility given to Moses, and something that was to be part of their culture going forward. I said Moses, Noah, and that was to be part of their culture going forward, was it was up to Noah and his descendants as they populated the earth, which is the next command we didn't read, to keep this as a standard within their culture. There's really only one detail given to us in this command from God to Noah about accomplishing this. And what's the one detail?
Blood needs to be shed for blood.
Yes, but how? It's a real, I'm asking you to see the very obvious here. But it's important. By man. It's a responsibility of the people to carry this forward. God gives no command about a justice system here. He gives no, there are no other details about how to carry it out other than as people, as mankind, as the ones that God saved, the descendants of the ones God saved through Noah, it's a responsibility that if a man sheds someone's blood, by man, then his blood has to be shed. So it's a responsibility for the people to carry out this death sentence, in essence. Okay? So that's to be a part of the culture, is that penalty on earth was to be carried out. Now let's go over to Exodus 21 for a minute. This is also important. In Exodus 21, we're going to be looking at verses 12 through 14. And I imagine you remember Exodus 21. This is in the time period. In Exodus 20, God gives the Ten Commandments to Moses. They're up on the mountain. And this is a part of what is said on the mountain to Moses about dealing with the offenses of people against each other. We're going to look at 12 through 14. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. If, however, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor, so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar that he may die. So Moses is given here a reiteration of the death penalty, but with a little bit of fine-tuning. If the man plots the death and kills them, we today would say murder, then regardless of where he may flee to, with regard to the altar, if he flees to the altar, even at the altar of God, go get him, drag him from the altar, and his death is to be forfeited at the hands of the people. But if this is an accidental thing or something not premeditated, not murder in that sense, then God says, I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. Well, guess what we see in Numbers? God is appointing the place for a man to flee if it's not premeditated murder, or at least murder in that sense of the way we would talk about it today. And so God says to us here in Numbers, going back to there, that here is a city that if a man kills somebody unintentionally in verse 11, then here is a place to flee to. and it's going to be called a city of refuge. Verse 12 says, it gives you refuge, it gives you safety from the avenger, so that the manslayer will not die until he stands before the congregation for trial. That verse is interesting to see how people interpret all that. Because there's one, if you read the verse one way, and it's kind of how I read it, he doesn't even tell the murderer he needs to flee there. If you're a murderer, get ready, the avenger's coming for you. It's almost how this is implied to me. But that last sentence, so the manslayer will not die until he stands before the congregation for trial. Even in the MacArthur Study Bible, he says, well, then everybody has to have a trial before the manslayer can take his life. And that's not a bad, I like that. In terms of that's the way it ought to be today. Just because you're sure I killed somebody, I don't think you should have the right to come and take my life. There ought to at least be a trial, right? Well, I'm not sure how that's all put together, because there are many times here in the Old Testament that God gave them a responsibility without, I mean, what did he tell Noah? Did he give any instructions on how the trial was to be held? Didn't even mention a trial, did he? Just said, if someone takes man's blood, that person should be at the hands of man executed. But we're going to see a little more of that, a little more refinement of that as God establishes Israel. So I can't give you a definitive answer about what about the man that isn't in the city of refuge and the avenger that gets sent after him to carry out what was said to Noah coming off of the ark. So that's what these cities of refuge are for. All of the 48 cities will be selected as they enter the promised land, and three of the cities of refuge will be east, and three will be west of the Jordan, and that's what God has directed. So any questions or comments so far? Well, let's look at verses 15 through 34. That's a long passage. But let's look at it, and then we'll talk about it, and we'll see what we can learn from it. These six cities shall be for refuge for the sons of Israel, and for the alien, and for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person unintentionally may flee there. But if he struck him down with an iron object so that he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. If he struck him down with a stone in the hand by which he will die, and as a result he died, he's a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. Or if he struck him with a wooden object in the hand by which he might die, and as a result he died, he's a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. The blood avenger himself shall put the murderer to death. He shall put him to death when he meets him. If he pushed him of hatred and threw something at him, lying in wait as a result he died, or if he struck him down with his hand in enmity, and as a result he died, the one who struck him shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. The blood avenger shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. But if he pushed him suddenly without enmity, or threw something at him without lying in wait, or with deadly object, or with any deadly object of stone, and without seeing it dropped on him so that he died while he was not his enemy or seeking his injury, then the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the blood avenger according to these ordinances. The congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the blood avenger, and the congregation shall restore him to his city of refuge to which he fled, and he shall live in it until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. But if the manslayer at any time goes beyond the border of his city of refuge to which he may flee, and the blood avenger finds him outside the borders of his city of refuge, and the blood slayer kills the manslayer, he will not be guilty of blood. Because he should have remained in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer shall return to the land of his possession. These things shall be for a statutory ordinance to you throughout your generations in all of your dwellings. If anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death at the evidence of witnesses. But no person shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness. Moreover, you shall not take ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. You shall not take ransom for him who has fled to his city of refuge, that he may return to live in the land before the death of the priest. So you shall not pollute the land in which you are, for blood pollutes the land, and no expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. You shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwelt, for I, the Lord, am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel. All right, well, in this passage, we get a lot of information from God about how to implement the use of these cities of refuge. And he starts out in verse 15 saying, these cities of refuge are not just for Israelites. They're basically for anyone that's in the area. And so God is not creating one law for the Israelites and some other form of justice for other people. And so in a very real sense, we see establishment of governmental authority here. You rule over this area of land. And with regard to the offense of murder, this is how you're going to deal with it, and you're responsible for it, and it doesn't matter who the person is. If they're inside your borders, you're going to take care of justice in the same way. And so in verses 16 through 21, God brings up the cause for determining a person guilty of murder and therefore getting the death penalty. They have a decision to make as a people. If the man goes to a city of refuge, once he's there, that person is to come before the congregation for judgment. And God gives examples and clear directions about how to determine the situation. What kind of verdict should the people have, the congregation, with regard to this person? And he starts out and says, if he struck down with an iron object or by a stone in his hand, or he pushes him out of hatred, or if he was lying in wait and threw something to kill him, or he struck down by hand in enmity, in anger as an enemy, these all fit under the category, God says, in verses 16 through 21, of murder. And in the case of murder, when you make the verdict, when the people determine they fit this category, then the guilty person is given over to the blood avenger to take his life. Okay? Pretty straightforward. But he also says there are reasons for finding a person who killed someone not guilty of murder, that it's not murder, and something like if he pushed him suddenly, now if he did it with enmity, then it is murder. But if there's no enmity, no anger involved, but he just pushed him and something happened and he died, or he threw something, but he was not lying in wait, he just was throwing it or moving it or whatever, like a stone or an object, and he drops it, and he doesn't even see it drop on him, while not an enemy or not seeking his injury, then these are reasons to find a person not guilty of murder. And so the congregation is deciding something, and they're deciding between a couple of points of view or a couple of points of interest. And it's in verse 24. Who is the congregation deciding between?
Between the manslayer and the avenger.
Yes. Sounds like adversarial court system, doesn't it? Here's the avenger. Now, we don't know what he might have said or how their proceeding would have worked, but here's the avenger whose responsibility is to carry out this death sentence because that person over there killed someone in my family, and I'm here representing the family to do this. And then the person that did it or is accused of doing it is over there going, oh, hold on. This was not murder. I didn't intend for that rock to fall on him or whatever the case might be. So you should not find me guilty of murder, and I shouldn't lose my life. And so the congregation has to decide between that. But if you go back to and look at what God gave as some examples, well, if he hits him with an iron object, does he get a chance to say, well, I didn't mean to kill him. I just wanted to hit him. Does that work? No. No, you got an iron object in your hand, you're trying to strike somebody. You can't go, well, that's not my intent.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about intent at that point. If you got an iron object and you pick it up and you whack him, or a stone in your hand, or you pushed him out of hatred, now you got to get at some intent on some of that. But if he was lying in wait, if you're lying in wait, don't tell me you didn't mean to do it. You know, one of the best learning experiences for me one time was I was in a men's Bible study, and it could have been me very easily, but it wasn't me. It was afterwards, and we're just standing around visiting, and somebody said something and said, well, I didn't really mean it that way. And there was a gentleman there that very quickly said the truth. Oh, yes, you did. And I don't want to embarrass him, but he's sitting on the back row with a blue shirt on. And he was right. And that was a very quick learning moment for me. We tend to do things and say, well, no, that... And I do have a problem on occasion. Well, I'll say something using certain words. And because language is kind of fluid. And somebody won't... They don't have to try to figure out how to say, well, that's not the twist I was trying to put on it. So it can happen where you say something and somebody takes it different than you mean. But most of the time, when you're being critical of somebody and you say something, you mean it. Get over it. You meant it. So the next time you get ready to say something critical about somebody, if you can somehow throw out an anchor chain and get that mouth stopped before it says those things, you might want to review what you're about to say and go, you know, I'm about to slander somebody, or I'm about to say something that I really believe is the truth, but it's not proper and appropriate to tear them down this way. That didn't edify anybody. So God kind of takes that same approach here with some of these examples. I don't know what their iron objects were, but I could put it in today's terms. You picked up, and I've got one. I've got a crescent wrench. Not a crescent wrench. I got a pipe wrench that's about that tall that my dad gave me one time. Maybe not quite. Now, it's made of aluminum, so it's not quite as heavy. But if I pick that pipe wrench up and hit somebody with it, I can't turn and say, well, I didn't mean to hurt him. What? You know, get over it. If you strike him with an iron object, don't try to tell us you didn't mean to. That's an open and shut case right there. Or these other examples that are given, God's making it clear, don't let them talk their way out of obvious intent, because it's there. And you might want to be sympathetic. Maybe you know the person. Maybe whatever would cause you to want to believe their story. God says, here's some examples where you can't talk your way out of intent. But he also gives some examples where things could happen. You're out clearing rocks, and you got a hill, and you push some rocks over the cliff so they're not in the way, and you didn't know there was somebody down there eating lunch, and, you know, there you go. So things can happen, but we've got an adversarial system, if you will, a lot like our courts today. You've got two points of view put forward. Now, we play lots of legal tricks. We've got lots of laws. These laws are a lot simpler, right? But it's an adversarial system. The avenger's there to avenge a death. The man ran to the city of refuge. And by the way, that word flee, I think, is very intentional and very descriptive. That guy better get his track shoes out, because he needs to get there if he wants to have a trial. But you're there, and so the congregation has to decide between these two people. Now, if the guy is determined to be not guilty, and we could have fun. You could go back into some of the examples of the laws, because if you remember this, you've got a horned, equivalent of the modern Texas Longhorn in your cattle herd, and he gores somebody and kills him. Are you guilty of murder? But the animal is. Well, the animal, the first time. What if he does it again? Do you remember? Now you're at fault. Because did it once, now I did it again. You already know. It's kind of like that old deal of putting up a beware of dog sign. You just admitted guilt. Do you know that? By the way, be careful before you put up a beware of dog sign. I don't know about today, but 30 years ago, lawyers would tell you, do not do that. Because your dog comes out and he bites somebody, you can't say, well, I didn't know he'd bite people. You got a sign right there that said, beware of dog. It's the same kind of a concept. I don't know how good that concept is, but it's the same kind of a concept. If you know your animal gores people, that's back in Exodus. You've got some responsibility here. Either you put the animal down or you figure out some way that animal doesn't get the opportunity again. Well, what happens in what God says here to the person that they determine is not guilty of murder, but he's a manslayer? Does he just go home and he's free now? And
he stays in the city of refuge.
He's got to stay in the city of refuge. And I can't answer why God set it up that way, but that's the way God set it up. Might be a little bit of, you had to at least be a little careless to get somebody killed. So, okay, we're not going to put you to death, but you're here, and you're going to stay here. What's the potential penalty for leaving the city of refuge? What's that?
You get killed.
Only if the Avenger finds you. There's only one person that can really kill you then. But if the Avenger sees you outside the city and takes your life, what's he guilty of?
Nothing.
Which is an illustration that needs to be brought up today in the world we live in, because the scriptures technically say, don't say, thou shalt not kill. That's how it gets put in English in a lot of cases in the Ten Commandments. But the scriptures, if you look at the words, really say, thou shalt not murder. And so there are times in the scriptures where we're commanded to take the life of a person. And I don't want to get into the politics today, but people that object to the death penalty often go to, thou shalt not kill. How can we kill when we tell them they're wrong for killing? Well, as a nation, as a government, the scriptures say in Romans, the government doesn't bear the sword in vain. They're not talking about fighting wars. They're talking about death penalties. The government has a responsibility to keep order. And if it's a godly government, in my opinion, they're very justified to have death penalties. God did. I don't know why a government would be in trouble for mimicking what God did. But that's really not the point of this. The point of this is God set up a standard where this person was protected. You stay in the city of refuge, nobody should bother you. But they do get to go home someday, maybe. When would they get to go back home? When the high priest, it was high priest when your sentence came down or your conviction was not upheld. When that person dies, then you can go home. Which, don't ask me to explain why God did that. God has some things in the Old Testament that I really think are wonderful. And I think this is in that same vein. One of them is years of jubilee and those kinds of things where you can sell your land, but every 50 years it goes back to the people that originally owned it in the promised land. I mean, there were times of resets So you had to pay attention. If you bought somebody's farm, how long are you going to get to farm it? Only until the year of Jubilee comes around. If that's next year, you better not pay a whole lot for it. The same thing's here, and I don't know why God set up this way, but all of the men, women, whatever, whoever was said it's not murder, they still have to stay in the city of refuge, but when the day comes that the person who is the high priest dies, all of those restrictions are off. You can now go back home and to your own property. It's an interesting thing. I'm not sure I understand why God wanted it that way, but I trust something. If God wanted it that way, it's going to work out really well if they implement it that way. Verse 24 talks about the decision that the congregation has to make between the two adversaries, the manslayer and the avenger. It has to be on the basis of these ordinances. They can't bring up some other thing. It's got to be the things that God's talked about right here. And so that's the limit. So I covered most of that. I want to talk about this kind of in general, and then we're going to go on and look at 29 and on. But in these commands, God's establishing justice. Justice for the kingdom of Israel. And it's going to work for society. It's going to work for the families. It's going to work for the one that did not commit murder, that's involved in the death of another. It's also going to work for the one that did commit murder. It keeps the penalties consistent. It lets people know where they stand. You kill somebody out of enmity, out of intention, expect to lose your life for it. And that's a good thing to know. It also establishes the holiness of Yahweh in the land. They're not just doing what seemed right in their own eyes. They're doing what God set out is how we're going to do business. And the more that they say to themselves and to the people that come and watch and are involved, or maybe even people that object to it, no, God gave us this and it works. We trust God to make it work. We're going to follow God. We're going to be obedient. And we're not going to tolerate murder in our land, by the way. And it also, if they go back and connect it with what was said to Noah, it upholds the fact that man was made in the image of God, and you can't kill what was made in the image of God. It's murder. In verse 29, God says, "These things will remain law throughout the generations and in your houses. The murderer is to be put to death," verse 30, "but," can they, now God brings in a new piece to the justice system. What is the new piece that we haven't talked about so far that you see in verse 30? Yeah. If to put it in a modern vernacular, God's not open to lawfare. And I don't mean that to be flippant or anything, but you could get somebody killed by giving false testimony. And that would be its own form of murder. But God says, no. We're not going to do it based on one witness. Got to have more than one. Jesus even talks about truth being established based on two or three witnesses, right? Got to have more than one. One is not adequate. And so God brings that into this mix. So now you can get even more of a picture of what's going on when they're making this decision between, is this murder or not? There's got to be some sort of witnessing. There's got to be some sort of testimony, is the way we would say it today. So, God is bringing that sense of fairness into it as well. It would be a hard place to be, and if the only person that could testify was already your enemy, wouldn't it? Ooh, that'd be ugly. And then he brings up some other things that really ought to be there. And I'm glad he brings it in. There's no ransom for the murderer. He's guilty of death. He shall surely be put to death. What would be tempting? Why does he need to say this? First of all, God did allow for some ransoms in other places. You know, you can put a value on this person's servanthood as he's given as a to be a servant. Oh, and you now want to free him from that? Well, then you have to pay the value plus 20%. You've ransomed him out. We talked about that a few weeks ago. What would be the temptation here if ransoms could be paid?
The wealthy could buy justice.
The wealthy could buy justice. Yes. And the popular might get free just because he's been a pillar in our community forever. And, you know, we all like him. And this Avenger's from out of town. We don't like him, so... yes, he was guilty of murder, but let's see if we can find a way out of putting him to death. We value his input. And so no ransom for that. The other one is, there's no ransom for the person who was found not guilty of murder, but as a manslayer, he's got to stay in the city of refuge. You can't buy his way out. And so God is doing a pretty good job of saying, when it comes to judgment penalties within your society for taking somebody's life, the standard is the standard is the standard is the standard. We're not going to deviate from it. It's going to be consistent. We're not going to be able to say, well, it depends on who you are, what penalty you get. Or it depends on who you are, if they'll carry out the penalty. Or it depends on who you are, what your limitations of borders of where you can go are. No. If you were a manslayer and you weren't guilty of murder, you've got to stay within the boundaries of that city. And by the way, something I didn't say real clearly, it gives the city some responsibility to protect that person too. So they've got some responsibility for his own safety. Until the death of the high priest. And then verses 33 and 34. God brings up something that I think is interesting. And he says, you shall not pollute the land in which you are. Blood pollutes the land, and no expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. God's clearly talking about murder here, because he's going to tell them to shed a lot of blood on the land, right? You're going to wipe out or drive out these people living in the land of Canaan. So God is talking about murder here when he says this. Do you remember what God said to Cain after he killed his brother Abel?
Your blood cries out to me from the ground.
The blood cries out to me from the ground. God's got a problem with the shedding of blood in murder. And he says it defiles the land. And the only way to pay the penalty, the only way to undo that pollution is through the blood of the one who caused it. That's God's words. You're not going to defile this land, he says in verse 34, in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell. You want me with you in your land? Don't defile it with the blood of those murdered. For I, the Lord, am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel. There's a holiness aspect to what God is saying here about following these rules. This is not only about, it is about, but it's not only about keeping their society on a level plane with regard to violence and murder. It's more importantly keeping the holiness of God in place in their minds and in the city. God says, if I'm going to live with you, murderer's blood ought not be on the land unless the murderer is brought to justice. I want to take you to a couple passages. Matthew 27, 3 through 10. Judas has betrayed Christ in this passage. And I'll back up and start with verse 1. It tells part of the story. Now when morning came, all the chief priests and the elders and the people conferred together against Jesus to put him to death. They bound him and led him away and delivered him to Pilate the governor. Then when Jesus, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, "I sinned by betraying innocent blood." But they said, "What is that to us? See to that yourself." And he threw the pieces of silver into the temple sanctuary and departed. And he went away and hanged himself. The chief priest took the pieces of silver and said, "It is not lawful to put them into the temple treasury, since it is the price of blood." What did they just say about that? What did they pay Judas to do? Well, we can say betray Christ, but they're extending it beyond that. It's blood money. He betrayed Christ so that Christ could be killed. We might in today's world say he's an accessory to the crime. I don't know. It might even not be strong enough in today's world. But they're saying he's guilty of the blood of Christ. And they conferred together with the money, and with the money bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. For this reason, the field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled, and they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel, and they gave them for the potter's field as the Lord directed me. Go over to Acts chapter 1. Now we're moving into Peter speaking. And the setting is they're talking about what to do about the fact that they only have 11 apostles. Oh, come on. I turned too many and then not enough. Too many and then not enough. We'll try this again. Acts chapter 1. And I want to read verses 15 through 20 out of his speech. And now I turn two pages. There we go. 15 to 20. After this time, Peter stood up in the midst of the brethren. A gathering of about 120 persons was there together. And he said, "Brethren, the scripture had to be fulfilled, which the Holy Spirit foretold by the mouth of David concerning Judas, who became a guide to those who arrested Jesus. For he was counted among and received his share in the ministry. Now this man acquired a field with the price of his wickedness, and falling headlong, he burst open in the middle, and all of his intestines gushed out. And it became known to all who were living in Jerusalem, so that in their own language that field was called Hakeldama, that is, the field of blood. For it is written in the Psalms, 'Let his homestead be made less desolate, and let no one dwell in it, and let another man take his office.'" And Peter's going to use the last part of that to convince them we need to replace Judas as an apostle. And they're going to choose Matthias. But do you see what happened here with regard to the blood guiltiness of the murder of Christ, Judas part of it? He helped see the blood of Christ shed on the earth. And his own blood then was spilled out on the field that was bought with the price that he was paid for that task. And when his body burst open, that blood sacrifice of his own death, then cleansed the work that he'd done to see Jesus' blood on the earth. Questions, comments? Seems to me it really relates to what God said there at the end of Numbers 35. Next time, we're going to start with the last chapter of Numbers. And that probably won't take a long time, so we may do some review and we may do some looking ahead to the book of Joshua. I'm not sure. But that's where we will be next time. So I look forward to seeing you then.